In those days, a man earning $1,000 a year regularly was a considerably, he could afford to keep a maid, run a car and live in a house and have a gardener come and do the gardening. So that if a jobber could make in a boom £4,000 or £5,000, for the next 2 years it didn't matter, he only made a few hundred. He could live on his capital during that, on his previous earnings. Of course, income tax I think then was half a crown or so in the pound. But as I say, the jobbers were very, very small, had very small capitals, but there were one or two that were the sort of leaders in the market who did the basic business, and would always, a small jobber who wanted to cut his book could always go over there and deal at a price. I mean, in the Kaffir market, the two big jobbers, Lazarus and Lemon, in those days, and they ran books because they had the capital, but most of the other firms were running their business on £1,000 or £2,000 capital.
Was the stock exchange conservatively, was the stock exchange socially a conservative place? Did they have very strict dress standards or rules of
Extremely. I mean,
behaviour?
everybody wore a stiff collar, a dark suit. In those days, the elite firms wore top hats. You had to arrive with a rolled umbrella, your shoe. You couldn't possibly walk around the stock exchange with your shoes not polished. Or in a loud suit. And that went on after the war for some 10 or 15 years.
Would you describe it as a reputable place in which to have worked? Were people did people maintain high standards in the way they dealt with each other?
Standards were extremely high. Anybody that didn't play the game or was found out doing something that was not correct, was ostracized and probably found it very difficult to deal. There was one, a very unpopular chap there called the Slug. Used to go round and round the market trying to check it with everybody, so they called him the Slug, and they used to sing "There's a Long, Long Trail a Winding." But he was unpopular and he found it very difficult to deal. Anybody that wasn't 100% straight, didn't get on very well. And it went round like wildfire, watch your eye for so and so.
Was there any reason, particular reason, why this person was unpopular?
Well, I believe the Slug, as they called him, he always wanted a deal in the middle and always wanted to deal something different. He was just a difficult bloke to get on with. There was another chap, Richard Slazenger, and in those days they dealt a lot in 30 seconds and 64ths, and he got the nickname of Richard the 64th because he always wanted to deal a 64th different from anybody else. You'd say you made it prices like 9 and over to 5/8. That meant 64th. Over 9/16 to 5/8. Well, he wanted to deal at over the 9 or 5/8 and under, and so he got the nickname of Richard the 64th. There were all sorts of nicknames for people there. Most of them was people like the fish and the goat, and another was a very small, extremely ugly man, and he was called "Don't Tread in It." There was in the mining market. And they all had their, anybody, one particular chap, he was caught on the railways without a ticket. So they used to get round and sing, "Oh, Mr. Porter, what shall I do? I got carried off the train at Crewe." You know the song, but they all, when he came in the story, they all sang that to him, because just because he'd been caught once without a ticket. And there was another person in the gilt market. He wasn't Jewish, but he looked Jewish. He was very sort of, I wouldn't say anti-Jewish, but he was very much the other way. And they used to get round the gilt market and sing "Jerusalem" to him. And whenever the market, there was a lull in the market, there was nothing doing, they always got up to some form of tricks to keep them amused or something. If it's a wet day, or nothing doing, some chap coming with a neatly rolled umbrella. While he wasn't looking, they'd undo the umbrella and tear up all these pieces of paper and then roll it up again very carefully. When he came out, they all watched him, and he opened the umbrella and he got covered in all this confetti of papers. Mm-hmm. There was always something that they found to amuse themselves. Of course, as a junior clerk or a blue button, you had to watch and look on. If you stood around too long, they say, what are you hanging about for? It was purely for members that they played on. And it was quite an extraordinary place. If you wanted a ticket for Twickenham or go to Wimbledon or have a piece of jewellery valued or a foreign stamp, was it worth anything, or a piece of silver, or what was the best way to travel to Naples? There was always someone who knew you. They said, go and see so-and-so, and it was always these people who could tell you, all these sort of experts in all manner of things, gardening, you name anything, and they had experts in it. Mm. In fact, there was one person there in the, Marzetti his name was, and he would get his hands together like that, and you'd say to him, play a tune. And by holding his hands like that, palms together, he could play God Save the King or Annie Laurie with his hands. Mm. There were all sorts of gifted people there. Mm.
We think of the 1930s as a time of political crisis, particularly towards the end.
Yes.
Did that affect the stock exchange?
Oh, yes, it's rather extraordinary. The up from 1938 onwards, the stock exchange was prepared for war and knew that war was coming, more so than the politicians. And
why do you say more so than the politicians?
Well, they didn't. Well, they wasted. I remember I got called up in 1938 in the Munich crisis, and there was an enormous number of young stock exchange people that joined the Territorial Army. A terrific response, and we all thought that war was coming. So on a Friday, if a jobber was a big bull of stock and he didn't like it, he used to go over to the Gilt Edge market and sell a bear and buy them back on Monday morning for 64th difference if there was no war. And it certainly put a damper on trade, but there was a lot of people, particularly amongst the older people, who thought there would be no war. But the people who knew more were coming for certain was the Jewish side of the stock exchange. Of course, in those days, was very, very big Jewish population in the stock exchange, much bigger than there is now. I think where I was in Stand 14, if you couldn't speak Yiddish, you didn't know what was going on there.
That was jobbers as well as brokers?
Brokers, principally. They were all, if you look up the old members book, 1906 sort of year, you'll find there's about 10 pages of members beginning with SCHW. Mm. But my governor there, Caro, he foresaw the war coming very strongly. A very amusing man. Once, when I was booking the options, he said, oh, you've done a big option here with Hal Thompson. I said, that's right, sir. He said, they're all right for money. I said, oh, I should think so. Their partner comes up here every morning. I watch you see him outside. He comes up in a Rolls Royce and gets out. Really? He said, how much does a Rolls Royce cost, hon? I said, about £2,000, sir. Oh, he said, they've got £2,000 less now than they had before then. 6 months later, they were hammered. But you had all those sort of people who used their nose and watch points, and it was, you know, a different world.
Do you remember what it was like during particular crises, for example, in September 38, during the Munich crisis, or were you called up at that time?
I was called up in the Munich crisis, but prices were severely marked down and business virtually stopped. Until the all clear went, then they recovered. But I wasn't here in when the war broke out in 39 because I was in the army. I was actually away at camp and never in the city. It was never called up. I was already in it.
Do you have any idea how jobbers adjusted to periods of crisis?
Well, when the periods of crisis were on, whatever they had on the book, they knew they had to nurse it, couldn't do anything about it. But I think they were basically running very small books and what I call cross books.
A
cross book is, say, they were a bear of £50,000 of stock and a bull of £50,000.
Did you get much sense of there being a social distinction during the 30s between jobbers and brokers, or did they all more or less came from the same backgrounds?
Basically, I think it was superior to be a broker than being a jobber.
How did that manifest itself?
Well, the brokers knew the moneyed classes and mix with the moneyed classes, where the jobbers had to rely on their wits or what they had, and only knew virtually new brokers. But there was, I wouldn't say a social distinction, but the elite side, particularly of firms like Mullins and Co, government brokers, and Pembroke and Boyle and people like that, the gilt edge market was the market where they were the sort of superior part of the stock exchange, and the big brokers that did the gilt edge business. They were considered to be I wouldn't say the elite, but the top drawer of the stock exchange. Whereas if you were a speculative jobber in the American market or the gold market, you were one of the hoi polloi.
Did jobbers and brokers mix terribly much outside of the house? Did you have much contact with jobbers outside of the house?
No. The big difference between then and today, although there was a great deal of friendship between jobber and broker, there was none of this entertaining, anything like the scale that you've got today. I mean, the scale of entertainment today in the luncheon rooms bears no resemblance whatsoever. I mean, if you did a good service and did your business as a jobber or option dealer, as I was, you didn't have to take the broker out to lunch to get his business, as they do today. The entertaining is enormous there compared. There's no comparison. None at all.
Can you describe briefly now how your career with Bailey, Mercer and Kero unfolded during the 30s? You'd started as a blue button.
Yes, I started as a blue button, then I became a dealer, then I became a member, then the war broke out, and then after the war there was no option dealing, so I had to start going into something else. Well, the only thing I knew, I'd always sort of been used to dealing and making a turn between two different parties. So I started jobbing with a pencil and paper.
So there was no question of not going back to the stock exchange?
Well, when I came back from the Far East, I felt a bit pessimistic with the Labour government back. I thought there would be no business there and no options. I felt a bit despondent. I didn't know what to do, but I decided that I'd try and make a living in the stock exchange, and so I had to pack up option dealing and did the jobbing. Mm. And when I was at Donison, we started there in the CAFA market, and then Parker and I gradually became the dominant figures in the firm after about 7 or 8 years, and were the money spinners. And then I went into the industrial market. We were one of the biggest dealers in store shares then, and electrics. And then we did extremely well, and then Parker then was 56, and we were the two partners with the capital. Mm. So as he wanted to retire, I did not want to carry on business as the sole partner with capital, so I closed the firm down. I went with another firm for a short time, for about a couple of years.
Which was that firm?
Sanborn and Co. They subsequently packed up, and then I just, to keep my mind active, you know, went with a broking firm.
Well, let's go back to 1946 when you joined Donison. Were you married at that time?
Yes.
How long had you been married?
I married when I came back from the war in 1946.
How had you met your wife?
She was a friend of my sister's.
And how would you describe Donison & Co. when you joined it? Had it kept on going through the war?
It had kept on going through the war. It was a rather... I think they had a good business, but they I think they got slack. They had a good contacts. And but they took on people who weren't jobbers, you know, old school tie sort of contacts who weren't entrepreneurs, you know, or business, whatever I call them. And gradually the firm was smartened up, and we were doing did extremely well.
Was it an old jobbing firm?
Oh yes, it went back, I believe, to about 1880, something like that. Mm.
Do you know anything else about the early history of the firm?
I know very little history about the firm. I did at one time, but I knew the firm before the war, of course, because they stood fairly close to me. There was a chap named Rowe there who was a senior partner. And it was, I put the, when I went there, we put their figures there and said we'd carry on, and then we gradually sort of took over the firm. But then 15 years, 20 years ago, whenever it was, a long time, some time ago, as I say, Parker and I had the 90% of the capital. He wanted to retire, and I said, I'm not going to carry on being the sole. I said, not fair on me and not fair on the others, because I can say, right, pack up now. And that was that. But we made quite good money out of it.
What were jobbing conditions like in the late 40s, 1946, 47, when you returned to the house? Were they difficult times for the stock exchange?
Yes, very difficult indeed, because basically there was no money. No money, no capital. But there was a good business in the CAFA market. But of course, the thing about jobbing is you've got to have turnover. If there's no turnover, there's no market making, no business. And once you've got turnover, making money or is comparatively simple. When you've got no big movements like you've got today in the market with small turnover, then it's a disaster. That's why they're all losing money and packing up, because they're getting violent movements and no turnover. What you want is little movement and big turnover.
Did you find you had a lot to learn starting off in jobbing, or did you feel you already knew a lot about the dealing technique?
I would say it came fairly simply to me, having sort of been a jobber in options.
How did you operate your pitches? Were you standing by yourself in the cafe pitch with your book, or did you have others with you, other dealers?
There were two. We always worked in pairs, so that one held the book and one was the sort of understudy, temporary, or when you were busy, took a book each. Where one went to lunch, one stood in for you. But it worked. It worked. But eventually what happened started with Wed Durlacher. They gradually started taking over smaller firms to extend their markets. And in the end, the jobbing, instead of being large number of jobbers with small capitals, virtually came to about five or six jobbers in the end, which again worked. Yes.
Did you have any policies for the firm in the late 40s? Did you try and steer a course in a particular direction?
Yes, we, the object was to consolidate the firm. And we took on additional markets. We went into the electric market and the motor market. And it was still predominantly stores. That was where the main business was. And we were one of the first firms to introduce some form of analysis. We compared British home stores, Marks and Spencers, and Woolworths, and got all this publicity in all the papers and one thing and another. But that was a long, long time ago. But we were one that some jobbers used to get little booklets given. But this was first thing where actual analysis of and comparing three companies, and profits per shop, and all that thing ever came out, and that was one of the starts of starting of analysis of companies by market makers. Mm-hmm. Most jobbers had no, all they wanted was a pencil and piece of paper.
Now you said earlier that just after the war, jobbing and the jobbing system was still more or less the same as it had been
yes.
during the 1930s.
Yes.
Did it start to change?
Yes, it started to change when jobbers found that there was that the prices were too close and they weren't making money.
Mm. About when was that?
I suppose it was about 1955-60. Mm. And they had meetings. I remember one meeting and nobody was making any money, and they were trying to get a system of making jobbing profitable, because it wasn't in relation to the risk and the capital employed, it was doing no good at all. There were various suggestions put up, none of them came anywhere. But one result of it was that when a lot of the smaller jobbers disappeared, they were swallowed up by the bigger ones, they introduced price agreements, which meant that each, instead of cutting the buying and selling price to ribbons, it was you had a fixed price. You could alter it as much as you like, but you, if they agreed on a 5p price, you all made a 5p price in the stock. You could deal inside if the chap opened to you, but you weren't allowed to make anything closer.
How did you feel about these price agreements?
I was against them because I was one of the smaller ones in relation to the Weds and the Aykroyds. And I said that we make our money by low costs and small turns, I said the only way I can compete with Wade is if I can cut them down in price. I said, because I know with their bigger capital they can make, where I can only make a price in 10,000 shares, they might be able to make it in 50,000. So I can't, only way I can compete is on the price, not in the size. So I was always against the price agreements.
How did you find, as a small jobber, competing with the larger firms? Did you feel that you were able to compete on an equal footing in your particular markets?
Oh yes, because one could, one I think was quicker at changing one's price when you saw movements. And insofar as you didn't run such a big book, you didn't get such heavy losses. And of course, when there was business, you could make close prices and turn them over.
What would you say your basic approach to jobbing was? Did you try and level out your books at the end of the account, or did you carry big positions?
I used to endeavour to try and go on dealing. But if I wanted to be a bull of the market, to try and run a bull book, and if I wanted to be short of the market, try and be short of stock. Mm. I thought that it was more important to have your book right than it was to make three halfpence between two brokers. Mm. And now I believe the modern system, as it is at this moment, is the only way you can make money is by having your book right. Mm. Not you. The days of trying to make a profit between two brokers is finished. Over. You can't do it anymore. You've got to either be a bull of the stock if you think it's going up, or a bear if you think it's going down. And you make your book that way now, to be a bull or a bear, rather than make a profit between buyer and seller.
Now, you said that from the late 40s, when you started manning the Kaffirs market, you then expanded into electrics and stores and so on. How did you go about doing that? Were the other jobbers quite happy to see?
They were never happy if they found somebody else competing with them. But in those days, if you wanted to open a book in anything, you didn't have to get permission. You just out of courtesy went round to the other and said, look, I'm starting dealing in General Electric and AEI on Monday. That's all you did. You started on the first day of the account. Just started up with pencil paper.
And how did you know what prices to make?
Well, you knew what the what they closed on Friday. And in those days they had shunters.
Can you describe what a shunter was?
A shunter was a person who used to deal for the country jobbers, because they had sort of jobbers and dealers in the country, Birmingham, Glasgow, Liverpool. And these shunters would come along and they went all round the market, because they always wanted to deal very close. And they played fair, you say. They said, what are AI for? And I said, be careful, Terence. Penny eight before and say be the right price. Oh, thank you. And they wouldn't, in certain time, certain cases, they'd keep you posted of what the market was. These shunters who won, of course, sometimes they'd say, oh, there's sixpence bid there, they knew I was short, can you give me sevenpence halfpenny? Well, they didn't tell me there was sevenpence halfpenny offered, but she might say, all right, but you did that because you wanted to keep in with them. And it all happened, it all went round by word of mouth, or somebody, what are you calling AI? Comes, oh, so-and-so, be careful, a notice just gone out or something like that. It was all done on a sort of friendly basis. And if anybody, say, knew the news and came along and dealt with you, and you hadn't heard the news, you'd kick up a stink and wouldn't deal with him again, because he'd taken advantage of information that wasn't known to everybody.
We today talk a lot about insider trading, and there's a lot of discussion in the press. Was that a problem during the earlier days in the stock exchange, before it was actually strictly made illegal? Did you find that that kind of information would percolate around the market?
Well, I kept a mental record of what I call my bad bargains, and it appeared to me that the biggest insider trading came from the merchant banks. When they knew a rights issue was coming, or through their corporate side, and someone, so-and-so, what's the size of this, whatever it was, you'd open your mouth, sell them to you, and then about 2 days later, out come a rights issue or something.
And did you have cases of jobbers taking advantage of that kind of situation?
Oh, yes, I think if a jobber knew something, or was told something, he'd... But then I understand that if you're a jobber in the market, you can't be accused of insider trading. It's your business. I mean, supposing, for argument's sake, take a classic example. Supposing a jobber, someone comes along and says, look, be careful in George Younger Brewery. I believe a takeover coming out any day now. And he's short of the stock. And he sees a limit there that John Smith and Co. want to sell 5,000 shares. He goes and bids them. Is that insider trading?
Did you have cases where jobbers were too close to brokers?
Yes. There were cases where there was obviously some form of collusion. But not much, I shouldn't think.
Without mentioning names, what form would that collusion take?
Well, the broker might be, there were one or two cases, might be the broker to the company, say Marks and Spencer's or something. And he had a particular friend in the market, and he would say, so-and-so, don't be short, this coming out, the bonus and all that. And that jobber would go a bull off them. But he wasn't told to all the jobbers.
And you said he was the shop broker.
Well, that's the person, really. The shop broker was known as the jobber who dealt for the company.
Do you mean jobber or broker?
The broker.
I see. And were these were shops things that operated quite commonly?
Well, this, what we call shops, the biggest shops of all, where the shops operated, was in the West African market, where there were basically rigged markets. You had people like Meyerstein and Latilla, who used to run the West African market, and how they did it. They wanted to get a share up. They went in and sold some stock and then bought it back. They sold it badly and then bought it back deliberately, all the shops buying. And someone else came by them, and all the time as they sold it, they bought a bit back, sold it. When they finished selling, price came down.
Mm. What kind of period are you talking about?
Well, 2-3 months.
Yes. But I mean, what was this a pre-war thing, or was it
pre-war and after the war. Really? It happened after the war in the Kaffir market in Freddie's North and South. Mm. They started at 5 shillings, they were issued at, and they got them up 15 bob. Mm. And all the time, the shop was buying and selling, and you could always take the stock in. In other words, if you were a giver of the stock on Katangos, then all of a sudden it got to 15 shillings, and you couldn't give on them. That they withdrawn the lending of stock, mm. and then the price went down after that. Mm. Went down to where they started mm. over a period.
Mm. And did you as jobbers often feel that you'd lost out through the manipulations of the shop? I mean, were you more often the victims than the beneficiaries?
Well, it's up to you to use your know-how.